Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is March the 2th, Texas Independence Day 2019, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. I always want to say 947-1111, but that's not the right telephone number. I mean, you know, 773-1400, that's hard to remember for me. 1111, which is our last four in our office, is much easier. And anyway, we talked about the fact that the economy appears to be, despite the fact that we got a 2.6% growth in first estimate GDP for the fourth quarter. And that's just, now that's an annualized rate. Think it's 2.6% times four.
That would be really nice, but no, that's not what happened.
Which means that for the year 2018, we had around a 3% gross domestic product growth. But the evidence is very distinct that, as we said last hour, there was some stockpiling going on in anticipation of tariffs, which meant that we moved some of the growth that normally would have occurred in 2019 back into 2018, which means we'll probably see slower GDP growth in 2019. The first quarter will be probably the big impact. And the other thing that I mentioned right at the end of the last hour, and I think it's very important, is we get these little indicators out, the Chicago Fed's National Activity Index, which is sort of like the leading economic indicators, came in and with a negative number. Now, it wasn't negative very much. It's, you know, it's just a little bit. It is down 0.43. But when you consider as recently as August, it was up 0.56. Now, those numbers are kind of weird esoteric numbers, but you realize there's a big move between a plus 5.6 and a minus 4.3. And while that number bounces around from month to month, we've got a pretty steady trend since August of slowing economic activity in the United States. Till now, the growth rate was slowing up till now. But now we're actually seeing, according to this one measurement, and one measurement doesn't tell you everything by any stretch of the imagination, we actually saw shrinkage in January in economic activity. Now, at the same time, we saw some other indicators. Consumer spending, because of the shutdown, we still don't have January's consumer spending official numbers. The Commerce Department released consumer spending numbers for December this week. So it's down 0.6% in December. Now, we're getting numbers all over the place for what happened in December. And again, it's measurement issues, largely because the government was shut down. But the consensus is there wasn't as much money spent going into Christmas this year as there was last year. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a certainty, but it's an indicator that something may be haywire.
No, in the middle of that, the stock market had a pretty significant drop in December.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a pretty staggeringly big one to drop down from relatively high positions down into a correction near bear market in 1 month is a big deal. And the fact that we have significantly recovered from that is important. But that was the mentality in December. So we have October, November, and December in that quarter. December, we had some real shocks to the system. And there are a lot of things that we don't usually see in the measurements. So we've got it all over the place. We've got good news and bad news kind of sandwiched all together in a funny tasting sandwich.
We did get a January number out of the Commerce Department that's important, and that's disposable income. It's coming out in bits and pieces what happened in January. Here we are in March. And that is disposable income dropped 0.2% in January. Now, this is all seasonally adjusted. But what happens is we're getting a lot of little bits and pieces of stuff, of data, that says the economy is still growing, but the rate of growth is slowing. And the manufacturing index, for example, went from 56 to 54. Anything above 50 is expansion. But what we've seen again since August seems to be, August, September seem to be the high points. the growth rate has been slowing, and the comments that the Fed gets from business owners have been getting a little more pessimistic. Now, this is the interesting thing. Despite the fact all these leading economic indicators continue to slow down, we're still seeing record-breaking hiring going on.
Yeah, so this is the lagging indicator and the leading indicator, and they don't always agree. Could be that the leading indicators are going to improve. We haven't had a sustained downturn there. We've had a very short period of downturn. And again, that we've had that in the past. We need to have a couple of those in a row, and then things could improve. What you were saying a few minutes ago, last hour, about if we get through March and we have a trade deal with China, and it looks like we're never going to have tariffs with them, or not going to have much in the way of tariffs with them into the future, expect not just the market, but the economy to do better.
Now, this is one of the issues that is well to remember. We've already got tariffs.
Right.
On Chinese goods. We've got tariffs on things out of Canada. We got tariffs on things.
Those going away.
South Korea.
Would boost the economy, immediately boost the economy. It wouldn't be, there's usually a lag effect for this sort of thing. It would immediately boost the economy.
I frankly don't see any discussion anywhere, and that's not to say the president couldn't suddenly do it. The existing tariffs appear to be off. Dropping them appear to be off the table now.
Right.
One of the things that, frankly, I don't know if the president remembers, he's got a 25% tariff on washing machines that caused the price of washing machines to jump 40%.
Right. I don't think.
Or a 25% tariff on steel out of Canada that caused that,
or out of everywhere, basically, caused again another 40% rise in price.
But we are going into a period of balanced uncertainty.
Do you mind if I throw in kind of a track record on what's happened with the trade war? We've made progress. The progress has been extremely painful, and that's something that people have to recognize, that you can't just say the good or just say the bad. We have a new agreement with Canada and Mexico, replacing NAFTA with the USMCA. It's not finalized. It still has to go through the legislative branches of all three governments, and it is mildly better on the job side and the profitability for workers side than NAFTA, but mildly worse in the dispute resolution side. So it's to me, having read it, it's not that different from NAFTA, but we made progress. There's one thing. We're making progress with China. This is the first time that we have had this level of talks about trade with China ever.
Right.
And that's a big deal.
There's no question. The Chinese were bending the rules and breaking the rules and pretending not to break the rules. By the way, Japan did that years ago.
Oh, yeah. And we had some pretty deep conversations with them. But our deep conversations was about getting rid of our own tariffs. We got rid of our tariffs and they kept theirs. We said, we're opening all the way up. See what happens.
Now, we still got, I don't know if you know this, we still have a 25% tariff on light trucks.
Yeah. Manufactured in Japan and sold in the United States.
Or in Europe.
Or in Europe, yeah.
And they've got a tariff on some of our stuff, too. But the concern that we have as economists is that instead of moving towards getting rid of tariffs, the movement appears to be add tariffs. And believe it or not, if you get rid of all the tariffs, you say, well, we lose all our jobs. No, we wouldn't lose all our jobs. We've had low tariffs. And right now we are at effectively full employment. If you want a job in the United States today and you're willing to move to where they want to hire you, you can work. I mean, even older people can work.
This is one of the pieces that's really important for people to understand here. Free trade tends to add jobs on both sides of the equation. So when people point at NAFTA for illegal immigration, It had an effect on illegal immigration,
but it lowered it
because people in Mexico didn't have to leave Mexico to get a job to sell stuff to Americans. And that was – it literally lowered illegal immigration. People could say, well, we lost a lot of jobs in manufacturing. It was shipped to different countries. And that's true. We did lose a lot of jobs in manufacturing. At the same time that we increased our manufacturing rate. We're manufacturing more now than we ever have in the history of the United States, but we're doing it with fewer and fewer people. And I don't mean combine it with the manufacturing facilities in Mexico and Canada and China. And no, I mean in the United States, we're manufacturing more than we ever have because of automation. And you said this last week on the air about VCRs. We invented the VCR in the United States, and the television was king in the United States. And there was a period when there were no VCRs being made in the United States. It had been all been shipped out, and people were very upset about that until the VCR was completely replaced by the next technology. And that's important to recognize, that in manufacturing, we're automating more.
Well, as we proceed through this, there's a couple of scenarios that work out. And one of them is, obviously, if the tariffs were all to be slammed into place, you know, the Commerce Department officially, although I question it, said that it was in our best interest to put a 25% tariffs on cars imported from Europe. I don't think that's correct. I think that was a political rather than an economic decision, but that's all right. And if we throw 25% tariffs on imports from China, we've said this, and not because I'm smart enough or Jake's smart enough to understand it, but because there's a consensus of economists that said, whoop, okay, that's recession time.
Yeah.
And I think the president has heard that. It was on Fox, so he probably heard it. And so I suspect we're going to get a deal. And when we get the deal, we're going to see some really peculiar things happen. The market probably will jump unless it's already anticipated the deal, and that's why it's up 12% so far this year. But the economy will slow. You grab hold of yourself on that one. Why will the economy slow? Because, as we mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of stockpiling, a lot of economic activity anticipating the tariffs might happen.
Right.
And we got to work our way through that. And the other thing is, Jake mentioned this last hour, and it's really important to understand. We're in a position where the economy is running pretty much full steam. It's hitting roadblocks in serious in many places.
Pretty well bashing through the roadblocks, but it's slowing down
right
every time it bashes.
And I still, this is Jeff, this is just my opinion, reading an awful lot of things, that we probably will see a second leg to the bull market even as the economy slows down. Now, we're not a final run-up in the bull market. I suspect, and I don't know this for sure, I suspect the market will close with some pretty decent gains this year and eventually break through to higher than it was last year, but not by much. Meanwhile, what we're going to see, and I could be completely wrong on this, this is just a consensus from the back of my brain, is that we're going to see the GDP slowing during the year and slows down to a 1-point-something% growth as we go through the year. It could be 1-point-something% in the first quarter. And we're going to see things begin to reverse while the market still goes up. This is, by the way, how we always end the story.
Right.
Bull market, is the market rises while the economy doesn't rise very much.
And then the market drops and then the economy follows. And now, sometimes the market drops and the economy doesn't follow.
And I suspect come 2020, things are going to start coming to a head. I suspect we're going to see a recession. I don't think it's going to be a big one. And I suspect we're going to see a bear market. And I don't think it'll be a particularly severe one.
Yeah. And some reason? I mentioned this a minute ago about car manufacturers aren't building big facilities right now. Well, if you think back, I realize it's getting to be a long time ago now, but in 2006 and 2007, car manufacturers were building at a crazy rate, even though sales were starting to go down. And then the price of oil went up, and the things that they were building were not in demand anymore. So all the big SUVs that they were building were not what people wanted to buy, and that was during the recession. Well, if you look at what they're building now, they're concentrating more and more and more on larger and larger automobiles. This is also a precursor to any type of downturn in the economy. We see this normally. But the good news, the things that two major factors that would say if we have a recession in the next 2 years, number one, we're pulling retirees back into the workforce, which means they were comfortably retired and they got offered something really nice to come back. That gives them a safety net when the recession hits. They just move back to retirement. They're going to be even more comfortable if they were using that income to build more of their retirement nest egg.
Now, will they be re-retired?
I think that is a re-retired, yeah. So we're all tired. They retired, and now they might re-retire.
So there could be a new class of people in the United States that re-retired.
Right. So one of the biggest hits to the economy is to the workforce. We get unemployment in a recession. And unemployment, you know, that lagging indicator creeps back up. And we may see it creep back up and then drop again in the middle of the recession. And people will say, well, what is that? Well, that is the people leaving the pool of interested parties. They say, I don't even want to start a new job at this point. I came back. I've had 3 good years. I've had 4 good years, more than I expected. I got more in my nest egg. I'm done. I'm out of the workforce. And so you see the unemployment rate drop after it raise with no new people being hired. Just like right now, we're seeing people being hired at a faster rate than the birth rate, at a faster rate than any kind of demographic thing. We're pulling people that were not in the pool back in. And then you add that with the initial investment in major manufacturing facilities, and then having a recession immediately following that hurts a lot of businesses, hurts a lot of big companies and little companies a lot. And they are reluctant to do the big manufacturing facilities. So two things very front and center let me say that the next recession is probably not going to be that bad. And that's kind of the normal recession, by the way, is a not too bad one where people don't really even know they were in a recession until it's over.
We did get some February data that just came out this week, and it's the Purchasing Managers Index, which I pay a lot of attention to, for manufacturing. It is, you know, manufacturing is not a huge part of our economy, but it is sort of the bellwether. When manufacturing, you can tell a lot about what's going on in the economy, because if things aren't being manufactured or the manufacturing is slowing, we're probably headed into a recession. It's pretty consistent. Now, anything above 50 on these indices that I'm going to report is growth. But here's the nitty gritty geeky numbers that we're working from. The February Purchasing Manager Index registered 54.2, really good, but it's down 2.4 points from January. That was 56.6. New orders were at 55.5, down 2.7. The employment index was 52.3, a decline of 3.2 percentage points from January. You hear each of these numbers, we've still got growth, not knock them out of the ballpark growth, but we've still got growth. As we go down through each of the pieces of the manufacturer's index, we realize that if the drop in February is as much as the drop was in January over December, then we will be at the 50-50 point, and that means that I should say the drop in February. The drop in March, if the drop is March, were the same number of points that it dropped from January to February, we would be right on the edge as far as manufacturing is concerned. And I think what you're going to see, very frankly, through the rest of the year is more of that, where the growth gradually bleeds off and things gradually slow back down again, and then the layoffs will begin to hit, and we'll go into that cycle. Now, what does that mean in practical terms? It means that for your investment, if you're growing your investments, I really think it's a good idea to stay fully invested. It's a good idea to continue to plow along. We're liable to get some decent growth in the market this year, and there's no guarantee we'll have a recession or a bear market the following year. So stay invested. If you are in a position where you have a major event coming up, like you're going to enter retirement in 2020 or 2021, or you have a major purchase that you've got coming up, then you're planning to take money out, just be aware that the market is pretty much recovered now. This is maybe, you may be looking at the time that you might want to harvest some of those gains. and park that over in some what we call dry powder, short-term bonds and cash, in anticipation of something you've got coming up in the next 2 years. Even though we may get a further run up in the bull market this year, it's better to miss a little bull than it is to bite off a chunk of bear when you need that money coming up this year. So those are the practical effects of what we're talking about. And we're going to continue to watch that sharp as a hawk, and we probably ought to watch our commercial sharp as a hawk
too. Yeah, let's play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Well, I said we were, but I have to hit the right button to get it to happen.
Well, that's the key technical skill.
Yeah. All right. Here we go. Here's the right button.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And to change the subject a little bit, there's sort of interesting things going on out there. Fidelity announced this week that they have zero expense ETFs.
Before you jump on board and say, woohoo!
They're also being investigated for hidden costs in other ETFs that they didn't disclose, and they're also being sued to 401k participants. So anytime somebody tells you there's a free lunch, you can be quite confident that there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This is not a not-for-profit organization. Fidelity's trying to make a profit. We like Fidelity. Don't get us wrong. I mean, they're a good mutual fund company. But if you heard that the hospital or a car mechanic shop was giving away free oil changes, you would say they're going to go out of business. Fidelity's not in the business of going out of business.
They're a for-profit organization, and don't get suckered in by and we do like low cost, lowest cost we can get within reason. But recognize if somebody is giving away something of value for free,
there's something wrong there.
There's something haywire, and they expect to make it up. And I think, but the irony is that the two news reports came out this week. One is that Fidelity is being investigated by the government and being sued for hidden fees in ETFs
and
that they didn't
401ks,
disclose.
Yeah,
and in 401ks, and at the same time, Fidelity announces that they have zero fees, zero costs on ETFs.
No, the lawsuit, and this is not concluded yet, so we just know what the complaint is that there were hidden fees and proprietary funds being offered. So when there's hidden fees, who pays them? This is a really nice question. If you get a car and they say, hey, we didn't add anything to the price, it's sold directly at MSRP, you still know that the person that sold you the car got paid. When you're talking about an ETF, and just for those of you that don't know what an ETF is, and those that do and haven't thought about it in a while, it's an electronic or exchange traded fund. It's a fund that's traded throughout the day, more like a stock in that regard. They have their own dangers. They have their own benefits. If you follow mutual funds, they don't let you day trade with mutual funds. Mutual funds generally trade at the end of the day, at the close of the market. So you can't buy and sell throughout the day. With an ETF, you can, which has some risks associated with it. But they're efficient. They're fast. They're liquid until they're not.
This is the way that the government's investigation is. The report in the Wall Street Journal says where government probes Fidelity over obscure mutual fund fees. And by the way, ETFs are mostly mutual funds, so this is
right.
A general fee. Said the fee is calculated as 0.15% of a mutual fund company's industry-wide assets, not just that's at Fidelity. In other
right.
words,
everywhere.
Basically, they had it's called the infrastructure fee, and it has nothing to do with the internal fund fees. According to Fidelity, they just charge 0.15%. That doesn't sound like very much
until you're talking in trillions of dollars,
but. It's just something to remember that if something is too good to be true, it's generally too good to be true. At the same time that this is coming out, two more reports of of Ponzi schemes that the SEC is getting court injunctions to shut down immediately. One of them based in Texas, $345 million. And I doubt very much of that will ever be recovered.
Right.
And basically, when you get an offer for a high yield, high return, something.
Low risk is usually implied there, too.
And guaranteed or whatever. You need to take a look very carefully, and you say, well, I don't know how to look. Well, look to see if it's got a ticker and it's traded every day. If it's not got a ticker on the exchanges, and mutual funds have tickers, for example, ETFs have tickers, and they're traded every day, and you can go to Morningstar and type in the ticker, and you can see it, and Morningstar often will have comments about it. If you can't do that, unless you're a very sophisticated investor, you need to stay away from it.
There's a term called sophisticated investor. You just said it. It's a technical term, sophisticated investor. It used to mean something very clear. The definition of it means that you have more than $1 million. That means a lot more people are sophisticated than in 1971.
But there are people who have lots more than $1 million in a 401k who do not know common
right.
stock from livestock. You're not a sophisticated investor under those circumstances.
I think the definition should be much better. Someone who knows how to research whether or not something is a Ponzi scheme. I would say that's a sophisticated investor. Someone who can look at a deal when it's offered to them. If you think about somebody that buys and sells warehouses or high-rise towers, that's a sophisticated investor. They go into that deal and they say, what in this deal could be wrong? Because the other side's not going to tell me about it. Those are private deals. The other side, unless they're just bilking people and really doing fraud, they don't have to tell you a lot of things. You need to do your due diligence. If you don't know how to do that, you can hire people to help you with that. If you hire someone to help you with it and they say, hey, this looks great, and it's because they've been making money doing it, that's not a good reason. They need to have a way of documenting the reasons why they're saying something is a good investment or a bad investment.
Well, for instance, on February 26th, there was a report the SEC filed an emergency action to shut down a alternative investment scam. And it was being sold through brokers. The brokers were in trouble, too, because they weren't authorized to sell it.
And they didn't their due diligence.
They theoretically was consumer. It was alternative investment scheme, called itself hundreds of millions of dollars in capital invested in local businesses. And it wasn't readily tradable, but it was an alternative investment, would hold its value, and would pay a high dividend. And it sounded really, really good, and $303.6 million went into it before somebody got to looking at all the stuff supposedly was owned by this in the documentation and realized, and this is literally what they did. They said, okay, here are the businesses that we own. In their documentation. Well, they
actually
went out to check out the businesses that were supposedly owned and found out
they were owned by somebody else.
They weren't owned by the company that the people just invested in. They went to the SEC and said, hey, the SEC, by the way, has a hotline for this. This looks like a scam to me. The SEC jumped on it. By the way, thank God for the SEC. They jumped on it during the government shutdown.
Yeah.
They had some people who were working without pay, who went out there and saw that, yep, this is a scam, and shut it down. It stopped at $3.6 million instead of $345 million. Now, again, if you're not a highly sophisticated investor, if you would say that you just don't know a whole lot about investing and you have to trust somebody, you should, at a minimum, have a subscription to Morningstar and look up every investment you have. And see what Morningstar has to say about it. In many cases, they won't have anything to say about it, but the fact that they report that it exists, it has financial statements, if it's in Morningstar, there's no guarantee what's going to happen to the market value of what you get because it's in Morningstar, but at least you're investing in something that's real. If you can't find it in Morningstar and you're not a highly sophisticated investor with a lot of time and a lot of money to investigate outside of the system, you shouldn't be invested in it. That's just solid as a rock. You should not do that. It's kind of like buying off-brand toner for your copier or buying off-brand ink for your printer. All you're going to do is wreck it. But you can't afford to wreck your portfolio. So Just be aware that there's a, for some reason or another, there's a lot out there. This is the returns, by the way, guaranteed returns ranging from 7.93 to 12.23% per year. Wow. Really cooking. Anyway, just be aware that those things are floating around out there. You got something?
I have a lot of things, okay. But let me hit some of them right away. The SEC is proposing a rule called the best interest rule, or the BI.
Which stinks.
It stinks. And we're,
it's in the best interest of the broker, I think.
Right. On first glance, it looks great. We do our business as fiduciaries. We do every effort to work in the best interest of our client. And we see a lot of very, very ethical salespeople out there that aren't fiduciaries and don't intend to be and don't need to be fiduciaries. As long as their clients understand that they're not working with a fiduciary, all is good. That's how economies run. I mean, you don't have an... there are people that have fiduciaries help them buy cars. But generally, you're dealing with a salesperson. And that's how you get what you're buying. The fiduciary has to deal with salespeople if you're not dealing with them. Well, the SEC and the Labor Department have both recognized, as has almost everyone else, that the word fiduciary is not a common English word. People don't know what that means. It doesn't, to most people, it doesn't mean anything. It's just sounds. And if someone asks you what's the difference between a financial advisor and an investment advisor, that's almost a joke. People are like, well, there's no difference between, but there is. There's a legal difference. So the Labor Department and the SEC have both recognized, hey, people don't know the difference between a financial advisor and an investment advisor. Nobody should be shocked about that, but people act like they are. And so they proposed this concept to do, at the beginning, the concept was to do something to disclose when someone is not a fiduciary, when they're not giving advice that's in the best interest of the client, when they're in a sales relationship. Because it's not a known thing. If you go to the car dealership, you know that you're going to need to negotiate. You know that you're going to need to go in there thinking this person's trying to sell me something, and the end of the day, they're happy with a sale, even if it's not the thing I wanted. When you go to someone to talk about investments, that's not your attitude. They're asking you very personal questions about your savings accounts, about your investments, about how much your house is worth, if you've paid it off, all these things that sound like they are working for you. Well, the SEC has proposed a rule that says they can give you a piece of paper one time that hidden in the paper says I'm not a fiduciary, and then from that point on, they can act very much like they are fiduciaries and not be disclosing to you that they're not. And that, to me, is a great deal of danger. It's not significantly different than what's going on right now. It's no worse than what's going on right now, which makes me say, then why are we making a new rule to essentially just allow the current environment to proceed? It hasn't cleared up the confusion. It hasn't gone any further to helping the world.
Regulation best interest can be summarized as saying the broker has to be reasonably honest, but does not necessarily actually have to act in your best interest. In other words, by definition, and there's nothing wrong with this, I'm not saying there's anything evil about it, but by definition, a person who's working for Edward Jones or Ameriprise or Merrill Lynch is working for Merrill Lynch or Ameriprise or Edward Jones. That's where they're employed. That's who pays them. And they're working to make that company profitable. That's their job. Now, they may be very, very ethical salespeople, but they're still just salespeople.
I think the vast, vast majority, way, way, way the vast majority of them are ethical people.
But their job primarily is to make a profit for their employer. And we have a caller.
On 773-1400.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have an unusual situation for me, probably not for other people, but my daughter was left a sizable gift by her godfather, who recently passed away, and it's primarily tied up in bonds with one of the large financial institutions.
Mm-hmm. It probably was a good investment for her godfather.
Yes, yes, because he was just looking at long-term
income,
incremental growth in it, but nothing for growth from an appreciation standpoint.
Right.
And I don't know what would be the best way to be able to unwind that and get it into something that would be a more appropriate growth vehicle. My daughter's 35, and I'm the trustee for the trust, and I'm trying to figure out what would be the best way to go about unwinding those bonds. They're all excellent bonds. They pay anywhere from 3 to about 4.25%. Very stable. Not much chance of anything going wrong with them.
Okay. I want to throw some things out there. You called right at the right moment, because the definition of fiduciary includes trustees.
You are one.
You are a fiduciary, and that means you're required to work in your daughter's best interest here, the beneficiary of the trust. And you are beginning with the right way. How do you even choose what is supposed to go in there? And my thought here is you need more than a call to the radio program. You can. There's a lot of ways approaching the sale of bonds.
It's a key element. You can do some initial research, and that is you need to look up those bonds and see what their yield to maturity is. Now, I know that sounds like a strange number. You may be surprised how low the yield to maturity is on those bonds. In other words, if the bond is, let's say, is trading at 104, that means that you're going to lose 4% between now and the time it matures. No matter what the interest is paid, the principal is going to lose 4%. And so when that's calculated in, you may realize that you've got a yield on that bond portfolio, a high-quality bond portfolio right now probably has a yield to maturity lower than future inflation.
If you find the opposite, that's a reason for concern, because interest rates have been wobbling slightly down. There's a longer term rising effect that we're expecting to see and that we have seen, but they're slightly down now. So you should see. It's called a premium when they're trading more than 100. So if they're priced at 104, that's a premium. If they're priced at 98, that's a discount. If they're priced at a discount, it's a reason for concern, because there's probably more risk associated with it than is expected. You have to be able to understand when a discount is a good thing and when it is a bad thing.
See, this is pretty complicated stuff, and this is where you need, in my opinion, well, let me put it this way. If you went to see a standard, quote, financial advisor, end quote, broker, they're going to say, sell them all and invest in something where I can get a commission.
Right.
And that's probably not in your best interest or hers.
We'll do it all at once, and you'll get to, if you are at 104, that premium, and it was purchased at 100, there's a big taxable event, and trusts are not famous for their nice tax brackets.
Well, she basically would wind up paying taxes if she's the beneficiary.
Right. Or the trust. It depends on how the trust is managed.
So you've got a sophisticated situation in front of you. I don't know how much money you're talking about here, but the ideal solution would be to find an independent registered investment advisor, not one that's working for a big corporation.
We have a conflict of interest here, and that's what we do when we're not on the radio.
And I can also tell you that there's probably not $1 million in that account, or you would have already found somebody, which is sometimes the minimum. But you've got a difficult choice, and one is to educate yourself in a big hurry. And by the way, what you'll find out is that there are certain mutual fund companies that will be that are very, very low cost that will be willing to assist you at certain levels. But you need some advice on that too.
What I think, give us a call at the office.
we may not wind up doing business long term, but the whole reason why we do the radio program is education. And I don't see any reason why educating you and pushing you in the right direction to say, here's at least some...
Well, I'm not going to push you.
here's some material to look at to learn this,
yeah.
Because it's okay. Pretty important. So go ahead and give the office a call, and we'll get something set up and talk through it.
The other thing is you really need to look at the provisions of the trust and make sure that you're following the provisions of the trust, and that is a pain in and of itself. But, you've just ventured into a complex area, and it's probably a good idea to get some advice from people who are not motivated to take your money.
Yeah, and what you said at the beginning, it's probably not unusual, but it's unusual for you. Well, it's generally unusual. That's why there are people that it's sad that the effort of your daughter's godfather to gift something to her comes with so many strings attached, but it does. You have to be able to make good decisions on these, and they're not that many. Instruction manuals on this are non-existent as far as I can tell.
First question that you need to ask yourself, what is your long-term goal as trustee for this portfolio?
For her long-term retirement.
Okay, then that means you really, really head off in the right direction at that point.
Yeah, we're not going to offer any
specific. I'm not offering a specific. I'm simply saying.
But you've begun with a goal, and that's the beginning.
And then you have to figure out what rate of return do I think is reasonable to get long-term to be fairly conservative so she'll have a good retirement. And then look at what you have and say, is it likely to get that rate of return? If the, you know, by the way, you need to subtract inflation and add in about, by the way, a balanced portfolio, rule of thumb, conservative balanced portfolio should get about 4% above inflation. If inflation's going to run around 2%, that means you're looking for a 6% total return.
And there's no place you can go for a guarantee of that. That means you're going to have to start making educated guesses, which means the educated part needs to get thrown in there.
Yeah, and so those are some of the very basics of portfolio science that we're talking about there. Okay?
I will give your office a call.
Okay. Thank you very much
for calling. Appreciate the call.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
And we do that, by the way. We help people who we don't take on as clients because, very frankly, they don't have a large enough portfolio that it would make economic sense for us to deal with it, but we can sure give them advice on where to go that they might be able to handle it comfortably and safely. And it's always a wonderful adventure. I've only been doing this 36 years, and I'm still trying to figure it out, but I'm a slow learner.
I think if you ever say you figured it out, by definition, you haven't.
Yeah, well, the chairman of the Federal Reserve hadn't figured it out yet.
Right. We were talking about regulation best interest before, and there was a couple of things that I wanted to throw out in the middle of this. If you're okay with us,
sure.
Swinging right back to that. The death of the DOL fiduciary rule. This was a rule that was strongly advised by Congress to the Labor Department in the Pension Protection Act of 2006. They said you need to do the research to figure out who's fiduciary, who isn't, to have a rule that says any retirement money is dealt with by a fiduciary. So this was in 2006. This was under George W. Bush. The rule got nearly to completion at the end of the Obama administration, but then has been labeled an Obama rule, even though it's not an Obama rule. It was a Republican Congress with a Republican president that passed the law. The rule was developed during two administrations by a bureaucracy that is supposed to not be liberal or conservative. It's supposed to do what Congress tells them to do. But in politics, it's a lot easier to point at any given rule and say that's a problem. And in this rule, it means that if you have an IRA, it's very limiting on the type and amount of compensation that someone giving an advice on it could get. It's also limiting on who can give the advice. They have to be a fiduciary to do it. Well, the law was passed. The rule was near completion. It was in its final stage and then was stopped by the Trump administration and then stopped further by a court to say it was overreaching. It was and needed to be redone. But now that rule is not moving forward at all. It's been given up on. Even though there's a law on the books from Congress saying to do it, it's in essence indefinitely delayed. There was no timeline on it, otherwise it wouldn't have taken till 2017 from 2006 to get canceled. Well, in the process of doing that, in the ramp up to that final rule, a lot of the investment industry was changing its practices on IRAs, figuring out ways to approach an IRA in a fiduciary sense, which I'm all for. Both of us in here are all for this. We're the cheerleaders for this. The rule was overreaching. The court said so. Now we need a new rule. That's not going to happen. So the result is that regulation best interest is being proposed by the SEC. Let me tell you what has happened since the Department of Labor's rule fell apart. A lot more IRAs have rolled over. They were slowing down during that time period of preparation for fiduciary, and now a huge amount have been rolling over, specifically into variable annuities. They've had record-breaking years for the past year and a half, through, well, 2 years if we've got the final data on that, record-breaking sales of IRAs moving into a variable annuity.
Whoa.
And those are not compatible in most cases. You're paying a lot of extra money for something you already have in an IRA, which is a tax benefit.
Now, a lot of people think they're because they pay for the death benefit in the variable annuity that they bought something that's very, very valuable. In many, many cases,
you can buy a term insurance policy for
right
less than a penny on the dollar.
Right. And there are other ways to get around that. Suffice to say that the annuity companies are reporting record profits on this deal,
right,
which means that it probably is not the best deal for the average person.
So that's a thing. We've talked about annuities in the past and variable annuities and how they have some benefits. But if somebody is saying, put your IRA in a variable annuity, that should be
a red flag.
A red flag. It may be perfectly all right. It may work out well for you, but the extra expenses are extra expenses, and we're about out of time. You have a wrap-up?
Yeah, everything seems to be cruising along. Our growth rate in the United States is slowing. The growth rate in Texas is still good. It's slowing. Everything indicates that we have a gradually slowing growth rate with delayed deliveries and a lot of things that indicate we're pretty much at the top of an expansion. It looks very much like, even though the economy's growth rate may be slowing during the year, the market probably has another leg up. No guarantees on that one either. And it still looks very much to me like a recession is a fairly probable idea in 2020.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, you've just heard us say it, not something we say very often during the radio program, but if you need fiduciary customized investment advice, that's what our business does when we're not on the air. You can call us locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's a contact form on there. You can send us an email directly. We read them for radio conversation. If you have a question for the radio, that's a good place to get it in. If you don't like your voice being broadcast, our email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Our webpage is chock full of interesting stuff. You can sign up for our newsletter there, too. You can read our past newsletters. And if you really are with a bent toward insanity, you can listen to programs that we have recorded of this radio program.